Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Prior to his election, the new president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, has said that it was his dream to end the nearly 50-year-long armed conflict in the country. Last week, he declared a unilateral ceasefire with the New People's Army, NPA, but withdrew it just days later. Still, the Communist Party has said that it expects to declare a truce along with the government on August 20th, the same day the peace negotiations are due to begin in Oslo, Norway. On today's episode, we will spend the full hour looking at the civil war that has raged since 1969 and the prospects for peace. In the first segment, we are joined by Jose Maria Sison, who is the senior political advisor of the National Democratic Front, which is the organization that will begin the peace talks with Duterte's government on August 20th. Mr. Sison is also the chairperson of the International League for People's Struggle. In the 1960s, he founded the Communist Party of the Philippines, which in turn created the New People's Army. The Philippine National Army has been engaged in military conflict with the New People's Army for the past 48 years. We recorded the interview with Jose Maria Sison just prior to the announcement by President Duterte that he was lifting or canceling his announced unilateral ceasefire on the basis that there had not been a formal reciprocation of a ceasefire agreement by the New People's Army. In this important interview, Jose Maria Sison explains the different concerns and considerations and questions about the ceasefire agreement announcement. From the Netherlands, we now talk with Jose Maria Sison, the senior political advisor to the National Democratic Front. Welcome, Jose Maria Sison. Jose Maria Sison, what was your reaction to the announcement by President Duterte of a unilateral ceasefire? Were you surprised?
No, we were not surprised on our side in the NDF because it was signaled to us that he would make such an announcement. And the announcement will just be an expression of intent, no? But then he made a statement which was quite fuzzy. He said he was announcing a unilateral ceasefire order which was supposed to take effect immediately. Question was, well, where is the text of the statement? So we asked for the text. And what came as the first text was the suspension of military operations order from the armed forces of the Philippines that came on the 26th, the day following the State of the Nation address of the president. And we saw certain defects in the SOMO, the so-called suspension of operation order, because there is no reference to stopping the ongoing military and police campaigns against the nuclear. And there was no reference to the withdrawal of troops from communities they were occupying, including the schools and meeting places. So it meant the document needed study, and eventually the party in the Philippines and the New People's Army would say what follows in the field. Then came on the 27th of July the so-called suspension of police operations, and this order included the tricky expression they will continue the legal offensives. And, you know, in the parlance of the police and the military, legal offensives mean inventing charges of common crimes against people suspected of having connections with the NPA. You know, according to a principle in jurisprudence, it is unlawful to multiply charges out of a single charge of rebellion. So there are those questions. But, you know, in general, when we gave President Duterte the benefit of a doubt, we said that we welcome his order and we would reciprocate. But then it takes some time to study the ceasefire order with its amplifications in the form of the SOMO and SOPO. And, well, it took some 3 days for us to wait for the substance of the ceasefire order. President Duterte should give us also time to formulate the ceasefire order. And then Luis Randoni, chairperson of the NDF negotiating panel, told his counterpart, DOLE secretary, the latest time for the exchange of the ceasefire order should be on August 20, the starting day of the formal talks in Oslo.
Your position is that the NPA and the National Democratic Front need some time to study what the president actually means by a ceasefire agreement, because the legal challenge could mean also other methods used besides armed conflict to prosecute or persecute members of the NDF or the NPA. Is that correct?
Yes, the implications and consequences have to be studied. But of course, there's a big leeway for the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Philippines, which is responsible for formulating the ceasefire order to the New People's Army. You know, the Communist Party of the Philippines commands NPA. It has a big leeway in formulating the unilateral ceasefire order. So I think it is relatively easy to reciprocate the ceasefire order of President Duterte. And there's a way for making the two unilateral ceasefire orders develop further. You see, while the peace negotiations advance, then it would be possible to make a mutual ceasefire order in a single document on the basis of the unilateral ceasefire orders. That was the previous agreement.
And again, just another question. Does President Duterte have significant support within the military high command for his offer, or is he doing this on his own? What's your opinion on that?
He has substantial support because, as a matter of constitutional prerogative, he's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And there's no other person to be regarded as the commander-in-chief. So, and he has just gotten his electoral mandate. So he can be confident of being in charge of the armed forces and the police, and he can reshuffle the officers. He can replace the officers beholden to the previous administration. Of course, there may be bigger dangers later when the United States, for instance, find the Duterte government off the line, so to say. And because, you know, sometimes Duterte speaks as a patriot, as an anti-imperialist, and sometimes he calls himself the first left president of the Philippines and a socialist. Let's hope he proves what he says. And if he proves what he says, then the U.S. will get angry at him. And the U.S. has the biggest influence over the puppet armed forces in the Philippines because, you know, the U.S. supplies the indoctrination, the officer training, the military supplies, and even the intelligence. So, you know, you have a puppet army in the Philippines, and it is traditionally an army of the reactionary classes of big compradores and landlords who in turn are subservient to U.S. imperialism. So Duterte would have to rely on the people. He will have to have a big part of the armed forces because, you know, the armed forces consist of children, the working class, and the peasantry. And many of the officers come from the urban petty bourgeoisie. Only a small number really come from the upper class. But then, you know, the army as a whole is trained to be a mercenary and puppet army, but education, political education, can be conducted rapidly, the way Hugo Chavez was able to re-educate many of the officers and men in the Venezuelan army.
Very interesting. We are talking to Jose Maria Sison. We're talking to him from the Netherlands. He is the founder of the Communist Party of the Philippines. He is currently the chairperson of the International League of People's Struggle and the current chief political consultant of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines. In an article put out by the ILPS, the International League for People's Struggle, and you're the chairperson, on July 28th, you talk about the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, ETCA, being upheld by the Supreme Court. And this is, as you put it, a stark reminder that the Philippines remains a staunch bulwark of U.S. imperialist hegemony in the Asia-Pacific region, and the reactionary pro-U.S. forces remain in control of the main levers of the Philippine state. What is EDCA, and what is the role of the United States in your country today?
Well, the United States would like to retain economic, political, cultural, and military dominance over the Philippines. And EDCA is a way of bringing back the military bases in 1991 as a result of the popular demand, a long-running popular demand, it was a way of rejecting the support that the U.S. gave to Marcos, the Marcos dictatorship, in exchange for the continuance of the U.S. military bases. But then the U.S. has maneuvered and has extracted quite a number of agreements, the most important of which before EDCA would be the Visiting Forces Agreement, which allowed the U.S. to bring its forces to the Philippines under various pretexts, like in training of personnel, exercise in coordination, and then later on other pretexts would be presented, like, you know, humanitarian mission, disaster relief, and so on. Then came the 9/11 thing, and that was used as an excuse to make the Philippines actually the second front of the so-called war on terror. It was ordered by Bush, so the Philippines was represented as some kind of a base against Muslim or Islamic fundamentalist groups, you know? And well, the U.S. has found so many reasons, including, you know, its pretense at defending the Philippines from neighbors, especially China. And so there is this strategic pivot to East Asia by way of containing China. So that's the reasoning. But, you know, the Supreme Court decision is unpatriotic and unconstitutional. You see, the 1987 Constitution, which was a product of the struggle against the Marcos dictatorship, put a ban on U.S. on foreign military bases and troops, and it also prohibited the introduction of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction to the Philippines. But then the shysters, the lawyers of the U.S. and those who are in power found a way. They invoked the the defense military pact, so-called. But, you know, it was only the Philippine side that approved it as a treaty with the Senate ratifying. But the U.S., tricky as always, did not ratify the defense pact. So this pact has been used as an excuse for making a series of agreements which, in effect, violate the constitutional ban on foreign military bases and foreign troops. So, focus on technicalities to obscure the most important issue, which is the prohibition on having foreign military bases in the Philippines.
In 1969, you and in the your position as the founder of the Communist Party of the Philippines and your other comrades helped launch an armed struggle, the New People's Army. What were the circumstances that caused you to take that decision to launch a military armed struggle against the Marcos dictatorship? And also, have the circumstances, the conditions changed? Can you envision a cessation of the armed struggle and another vehicle for struggle for the Filipino masses?
You know, the Philippines, as a semi-colonial, semi-full country, is always in crisis, in chronic crisis, and people suffer the most extreme forms of oppression and exploitation. And Marcos was already trying to lay the ground for his fascist dictatorship. He himself said there was a social volcano that was about to explode, and he himself would make his fascist dictatorship as the solution. Right now, there seems to be an opportunity to adopt effective measures other than the people's war, without really saying that the people's war is already out of date. No, the point is, at this time, it is possible to have a truce and alliance with a government like that of Duterte. We hope he will agree and prove himself to be truly a patriotic and progressive leader. If he proves himself to be such, then the revolutionary forces will certainly engage in a united front with him in order to face up and fight U.S. imperialist domination and the oppression and exploitation being carried out by the oligarchy of big compradors and landlords in the Philippines.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We are completely out of time. We've been joined from the Netherlands by Jose Maria Sosson. Thank you, Mr. Sosson, for joining us. He is the chairperson of the International League of People's Struggle and the chief political consultant of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Is peace on the horizon in the Philippines? New President Rodrigo Duterte declared a unilateral ceasefire with the New People's Army earlier this week. With peace talks expected next month, does that mean that the nearly five decades long armed conflict is coming to an end? What are the social and political ramifications? We are joined from the Philippines by Bernadette Ellerin. She is the chairperson of Bayan USA. And from California by Rhonda Ramiro, vice president of Bayan USA. Welcome, Bernadette and Rhonda.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning, good evening from the Philippines. Yeah,
you're in a different time zone there. Bernadette, you are in the Philippines. Talk about why you're there, what kind of actions Bayan USA and others who are fighting for justice in the Philippines have been engaged in the recent days.
Yeah, so a few days ago, the Philippine Supreme Court ruled that the new defense pact between the U.S. and the Philippine government, the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, or the EDCA, as we call it, is actually constitutional. So this agreement essentially allows the building of U.S. military facilities all over the country. And we are here because we're here with a group of other allies from the U.S. to protest the building of a new military facility in Lumbia Airport, which is in Cagayan de Oro in Mindanao. It's the only location under EDCA that is in Mindanao. So today we had an action where the allies from the U.S. actually tied themselves to the gate of the airport as a symbolic protest to the building of a new U.S. military facility. So it was actually an action we were joined by, we joined the protest of Lumbia residents, and most of them are, there are about 230 urban poor families in the Lumbia airport that will be displaced because of the building of the new U.S. military facility. There are currently squatter communities there that are facing demolition to give way to the U.S. military facility. And we believe this is going to be a drone center, which the U.S. government really wants to establish in the Mindanao region. Mindanao being the so-called second front of the war on terror, as proclaimed by George W. Bush back in 2002.
Rhonda Ramiro, I want to ask you about that. that issue? Because here you have the United States with the Philippine government and previous Philippine administrations trying to construct and have regulations and laws and agreements and treaties, and now it's been upheld by the Philippine Supreme Court, to reposition huge amounts of U.S. military equipment, weapon systems, new technologies. There was, of course, in the 1970s, the 1980s, the struggle, the mass struggle of the Filipino people to close Clark Air Base and the Subic Bay naval bases, the huge U.S. military installations in the Philippines. Those were successful, but now you have the United States coming back. Of course, it didn't just come back, but it's coming back a full scale. And it comes at a time when the new Philippine president says that he's seeking a ceasefire, an agreement, a resolution of the arms struggle. And yet you have, at the same time, this overarching sort of dominating force in the Philippines, that would be the United States, trying to do something quite contrary. Talk about it.
That's right. Yeah, we know that the U.S. will never allow its jewel of the Orient to go away peacefully. No matter how much President Duterte takes this stand, where he's in the past said he does not want U.S. military on his soil. When he was mayor of Davao City, he took a position against refusing entry of U.S. drones into Davao. And it was this very significant stand, and also kind of a black eye to the U.S. So they aren't fond of Duterte for that position. Nevertheless, the U.S. will continue to find ways to deploy its military, deploy its ships and air equipment and so forth and weapons into the country. They're doing it all over the Asia Pacific as part of what's been dubbed by Hillary Clinton way back in 2012 as the Asia Pacific pivot. So as you said, deploying 60% of its naval and air power into the region. And they're finding ways through these really kind of sneaky military agreements, which get around the constitutions of different countries. They're trying to do this with the Jeju base in Korea. They're trying to deploy and build new bases in Okinawa, and the Philippines is no different. I think one of the worst provisions of this new agreement is that it allows the U.S. to put its troops into existing Philippine military bases and claim that they're not U.S. bases, when in fact, the entire occupants of the base will be American. So how is that not an American military base if it's full of American service people and equipment? And then the other really horrible aspect of it is that the price tag is paid by the Philippines, by the Filipino people. The U.S. doesn't even pay rent on using these facilities. So they're getting what they want free of charge, and then using it to be able to ensure that they have this very important geopolitical strategic position very close to China.
And that's amazing. So the Filipino people are functioning really as a provider of a welfare subsidy for the American military industrial complex, footing the bill for the occupation of their own country. Bernadette, let's talk about the bigger context of this, because here you have the United States. It invaded the Philippines more than 118 years ago. It was the Philippines functioned as a colony of the United States. You have a new government in the Philippines that seeks to have a different path, a different political path, but still the overarching domination of the United States over the Philippines. And under those circumstances, what will be the prospects for those forces in the Philippines who have long sought, either through armed struggle or through political civil struggle, to really have independence, have sovereignty, have genuine freedom for the people in the Philippines and for the country?
Well, you know, I think we're optimistic, but we're not delusional about the new administration of Duterte. You know, Duterte has a solid track record of being anti-U.S. intervention in Mindanao when he was mayor of Davao City, the largest city in Mindanao, for almost 20 years. And in that context, Bayan has had a tactical alliance with him. Duterte has made very strong positions against CIA operations, drone operations in Mindanao. He denied the U.S. government, the U.S. military, the right to establish a drone center in Davao. So I think those things have been positive But these things have to translate, and we have yet to see these things translate into Duterte as president of the Philippines. So we welcome his pronouncements, especially the pronouncement to resume the formal peace talks between the government of the Philippines and the National Democratic Front of the Philippines, you know, which speak directly to the 47-year civil war between the New People's Army and the Armed Forces of the Philippines. But again, like, we have yet to see actions beyond pronouncements. So while we welcome these pronouncements, we have yet to see them put into practice and implemented.
Rhonda Ramiro, the Bayan USA, when you go to your website, there's a set of demands and calls for the president, Duterte, actions that he can take, should take, some of which he has perhaps started to take, that would be significant, call for advancing the peace talks with the National Democratic Front, appointing progressives to the presidential cabinet, etc. Talk about those 5 points, if you would.
Well, sure. So the program for change, Bayan has been pulling together people from around the country to put together what's called the People's Agenda for Change. So actual doables that Duterte could put in place that would significantly change business as usual in the Philippines, allow for the economic and social reforms that could actually set the Philippines on a different path towards independence. And so that's what the points are about. That's what the agenda is about. Eradicating, you know, the crushing poverty that has gripped the Philippines ever since it became a country. So we talked about upholding national sovereignty and territorial integrity. So, you know, foremost in that is getting rid of some of these treaties and agreements between the Philippines and the U.S. that have allowed the Philippines to be under U.S. imperialism since our founding, exactly like the EDCA agreement, which Bernadette was just talking about earlier. And that includes also, when we talk about upholding sovereignty and territorial integrity, that includes incursions by China. It's been quite a bit in the news over the past week that China has been trying to reclaim land around and sea around the Philippines, which the Philippines claims we have a historic right to. And so there are legal rulings that belongs to the Philippines, and that there should be that China should be hands off and should allow the Philippines to maintain its control over those waters and that land. So when we talked about sovereignty, we are talking about Philippines for Filipinos and not under the thumb of the U.S. or China. You know, we've talked about on our agenda that there should be these social and economic reforms, so national industrialization, genuine land reform, meaning that the 60% of the population, which is still in the countryside, should own the land that they till and shouldn't be under the thumb of these huge landlord families, which own the majority of the land and keep the majority of the population poor. We talk about economic sovereignty. So, you know, even as the Philippines is not yet a member of the countries who are agreeing to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it is still a possibility, and there's been a lot of pressure on former President Aquino to change the constitution and to allow the Philippines to join that, which would just tie the country to the dictates of U.S. imperialism and the dictates of its, you know, neoliberal economic agenda, while continuing to impoverish the Philippines even more. So these are the kinds of changes that we think need to be prioritized in order for the Philippines to even begin to root out the roots of poverty and injustice in the country.
Bernadette, talk about how big of a problem poverty is in the Philippines. I think for our audience, which is, of course, a U.S. audience, a general U.S. audience, we also have a global audience. People hear about the Philippines with grand announcements, certain flashy media sensationalist stories, whether it has to do with disputes in the South China Sea or the recent ruling at The Hague that came out in favor of the Philippines and its conflict with China, or other sort of internationally interesting matters. But in terms of the conditions for the masses of people in the Philippines, there's not too much press. And just talk about what the status of people is throughout the country.
Correct. Well, the majority of the people who live in the country are from the rural communities in the countryside. They have no other means of livelihood but to plant, to till the land. and yet they are in no position, they have no power to determine what they till. And that leaves them in a very, very impoverished situation. Because like Rhonda said, in the Philippines, which is an agricultural country where the vast majority of the people live off the land, but the thing is, it's dominated by landlords who ensure that those who till the land do not have the power to own it, do not have the power to determine how to operate on it. So this leaves a vast majority of the Filipinos poor and suffering from hunger. The Philippines is an import-dependent, export-oriented economy, and that's because of liberalism. And this basically leaves the economy in a state of chronic deficit and chronic debt. The fact that almost 6,000 Filipinos have to leave the country every day to look for work is the biggest indicator of the socioeconomic crisis in the country, of the fact that there is poverty in the country. 60 million Filipinos are living below the poverty line, and that's under Benigno Aquino III, which was the former president. And no matter what the corporate media says, or no matter what the ruling elite says here in the country, the Filipino people are poor. It's just that if there's any so-called growth in the economy, it's because of the dollar remittances of Filipino overseas workers, because overseas workers leave the country and they remit so much. Over $20 billion comes from U.S. dollars flows back into the country because of overseas Filipino workers. And that is not a model for sustainable development. That's not a model for developing our economy. That's an artificial appreciation of the Philippine peso. So, and I think that creates a very deceptive picture, this illusion that there's economic growth in the country when there isn't. You know, if Filipinos are still leaving and people in the country are still starving, that's not growth at all.
That's Bernadette Ellerine. She is the chairperson of Bayan USA. We're also speaking with Rhonda Ramiro, vice president of Bayan USA. Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to keep this story going, of course. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The roots of the war in the Philippines extend far beyond 1969. To really understand the nature of the conflict in the Philippines, we need to look at the long history of colonization and resistance. To help us do that, we are joined by Adrian Bonifacio. He is the chairperson of Anak Bayan USA, and Nat Pampana. He is the vice chairperson of the same organization. Welcome, Adrian and Nat.
For having us.
Thank you.
The U.S. military in the Philippines claims that it has deployed its forces to stabilize the country and the region. But in reality, the U.S. presence in some ways, maybe always, resembles an occupation, making the conflict or conflicts worse. Talk about that, if you would. Let's start with you, Adrian.
Right. And so what you mentioned about the U.S. being there as kind of an occupying force, that really dates back to the origins of U.S. colonization in the Philippines. So after the 400 plus years that Spain came to colonize the Philippines, the U.S. came as kind of the next rising imperial power in the world. And it basically bought the Philippines for $20 million in 1898. It bought it along with Cuba, Guam, and Puerto Rico in this kind of deal that they had with Spain. And since then, U.S. troops have been on the ground in the Philippines. They fought a very brutal war. Some people call it the first Vietnam, actually, because there were so many people that were killed. It's when the U.S. was able to employ its tactics of torture, things like waterboarding. They were able to put people into concentration camps. And so that is really the legacy and the history of U.S. occupation of the Philippines dates back to the turn of the century when the Philippines was really first colonized by the United States.
Nat Pampana, let's talk a little bit more about that origin, about the starting point, where the United States replaced Spain as the dominant colonial power in the Philippines. That came about as a consequence of what we know in American history, or what we're taught in American history classrooms, is the, quote, Spanish-American War. But that Spanish-American War was a devastating invasion and occupation of the Philippines. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps more than a million Filipinos died as the U.S., even though it had bought the Philippines from Spain, was incapable of subduing the resistance of the Filipino people without just a genocidal type onslaught. Talk about what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what we're taught in history, in our classrooms here in America, and even in the Philippines, is how this manifest destiny came about. But in reality, what really happened was that there was a crisis here in America, with a crisis over production of capitalism, where the U.S. was at the was a burgeoning imperialist power. It needed a foreign market to expand to and to exploit, and new neo-colonies to get raw resources from. And so it sought those countries that Adrian mentioned earlier, those Spanish neo-colonies. So it really used force. And besides that, with this new phase of imperialism, it also used other state apparatuses to colonize its neo-colonies, like the Philippines. So besides the use of force, of weapon, there was also a use of culture. You know, so education and quote unquote democracy was used in the Philippines. So school systems were made sure to teach American values, to make sure that Filipinos aspire to become subjects of America, starting from elementary school, with the deployment of Thomasites, who were the first teachers, white teachers, to teach in the Philippines, to the setting up of the universities in the Philippines, that those universities that still stand up to now. So the culture in the Philippines really has, current culture in the Philippines really has colonial roots, that it really served to maintain the colonial status quo in the Philippines. Besides that, the first laws that were enforced in colonial Philippines were repressive laws, establishment of the Philippine Constabulary to make sure to quash the existing rebellion or the existing resistance of Filipinos back then. And those continued throughout the decades. On the economic front too, treaties and economic agreements were used so that U.S. business interests had monopoly over the resources and businesses and the economy of the Philippines.
Okay, we're talking about the Philippines. We're talking about Philippine history and specifically about U.S. and Philippine history. Adrian Bonifacio is the chairperson of Anak Bayan USA. Nat Pampana is the vice chairperson of that organization. Adrian, let's just go up the sort of chronologically climb through the 20th century, if we could. The United States comes in during this so-called Spanish-American War, kills a million Filipinos. There was a very large anti-war movement, a movement against imperialism, the U.S. Anti-Imperialist League, led partly by Mark Twain. Thousands, tens of thousands of people in the United States opposed the colonization of the Philippines, but that movement was sort of short-lived because if it was the advent of the United States' entrance into the imperial scramble, certainly that solidified by World War I and then the end of World War I, where the U.S. was emerging as the second great power after Britain in the world. But after World War II, the United States emerged as the dominant power, certainly within the capitalist sphere of influence. The people in the Philippines were always fighting to be free. You had military occupation, you had the cultural impositions by the United States, but the people's resistance continued. After World War II, talk about the war that developed as part of the struggle for national liberation.
Right, and so that struggle, as you mentioned, continued throughout U.S. occupation. So the Filipino-American War, which came about when the U.S. first colonized the Philippines, that went on for, in the U.S. history textbooks, maybe only around 3 years, but in reality, it was more than a decade long. And then if you go further in history, you have, of course, the Japanese occupation, and then there's Filipino resistance to that, too. There was an army called the Hukbalahap that was fighting for freedom against Japanese occupation that also eventually tried to fight against U.S. occupation when the U.S. returned after the Japanese were out of the Philippines. And so after that point, there had always been a movement, kind of a mass movement, so people clamoring on the streets to fight for independence, but then also an armed movement happening. And so that's really what we see after World War II. There's this period of unrest where people are still granted independence, but then they're slowly starting to see that this independence is a sham, that there are so many treaties, as Nap had mentioned, that the U.S. had signed between the government of the Philippines and the U.S. government that really allowed for neo-colonial rule of the Philippines. So in terms of economy, in terms of military, there's still the vestiges of those kinds of systems that continue till today, that continue to put the Philippines under the subjugation of the United States. And so that's why there, you know, in 1969, I'm sure you've spoke with Jose Marie Sison about this, but that's where they saw the conditions as the same. Even though they had been granted nominal independence, the root problems of U.S. colonization of the Philippines were still there. And so that's why in 1969, there again was another armed revolution that was starting, in addition to, of course, the mass movement of people that was fighting against U.S. imperialism, its kind of hidden form as a imperialist power, and the Philippines as a neo-colony.
Nat Pampana, the struggle of the Filipino people in the recent decades has taken many, many forms. There is, of course, the armed struggle, which is the war led by the New People's Army under the direction of the Communist Party of the Philippines. There are also unions. There's the massive trade union movement. There is also student movements, youth movement, peasant movements, a wide variety of constituent-based and issue-oriented struggles, more or less all going in the same path, even though they may have separate identities. The path is for the Philippines to be independent, to have a revolutionary change, to get rid of the vestiges of feudalism and, of course, imperial domination. One of the focuses or foci of this struggle in the 70s and 80s was against the Subic Bay and Clark Air Base, the Subic Bay Naval Base, the United States, and the Clark Air Base. These were U.S. military installations, perhaps the largest in Asia, perhaps the largest in the world outside of the United States. The mass movement of the Filipino people led to those being shut down. But now we have EDCA and the new sort of language, the new vernacular being used, but allowing the United States, the military, the U.S. military, to come back in under sort of different language, but still it's there. How big of a deal is that for the struggle right now?
One of the main things that really the movement is fighting about, because the movement that we're talking about is called the National Democratic Movement because mainly of two things, right? The national, referring to our fight for sovereignty of our own country, that we have economic, military, political, cultural independence from foreign domination. And the most dominant of that in the Philippines right now, of course, is the U.S. And the second part of national democracy, meaning for the people to be granted their own democratic rights, their democratic interests in land, in ownership to land, to jobs, education, etc. And so the struggle to repudiate EDCA, or the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement right now, is one of our main fights, because it really shows the domination of the U.S., not just in the Philippines, but in that specific region of the world. It shows how the U.S. is in crisis. You can see how the EDCA has been approved alongside, around the same time as a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is one of the, they call it the NAFTA on steroids, right? Because it's one of the largest trade partnerships that the world has seen to date. And so that historically, we can see that whatever economic interests the U.S. has in whatever part of the world has always been safeguarded or has always come with military implications. And so we are not going to buy, and we are actively defending the narrative of the U.S. of so-called safeguarding peace and order around the world. We maintain our stand, you know, that we will not be, we will not let the U.S. police the different countries in the world. We will not, we are a sovereign country, or we are continuing to fight for a sovereign country because we believe that we can actively defend it, and we do not believe the U.S.'s imposition that it is there to protect the the Philippines against regional threats such as China or any other threats that it perceives to be in the region.
Right. So the United States obviously now seeking to provide its intervention in the Philippines with a noble-sounding cause, as it's there to protect the Philippines from China. But of course, you can see from the last 100 years, the United States has not had a tender place in its heart for the rights and status of the Filipino people or the Philippines as a country. Certainly, we can see that through this long, long, bloody history of invasion and occupation. Adrian, I want to ask you about President Duterte. We have about 3 minutes left. He announced before his election that one of his dreams was to bring the armed struggle to an end. In other words, to have a peaceful resolution. He announced a unilateral ceasefire a little while ago. When I talked to Jose Maria Sison in a pre-recorded interview a couple days ago for this segment, Jose Maria Sison said there was kind of a guarded optimism, but the movement was demanding more information about the details of what a unilateral ceasefire agreement really was. He asked Duterte to be patient, but Duterte, as of 2 days ago, has suspended or lifted the unilateral ceasefire, although peace talks are still scheduled for Oslo on August 20th between the Duterte government and the National Democratic Front. In our last 2 minutes or so, Adrian, talk about what you see coming with these negotiations.
Right. So with the negotiations, we can see that both sides, and hopefully the Duterte government, will still be open. It seems like they're still open. There was he made a statement earlier, I believe this morning or yesterday, that he hoped that the peace talks would continue, and then it seems that CPP and NPA NDF is also willing to continue those peace talks in spite of the events that happened with the unilateral ceasefire. And so I think what really we need to focus our attention on is making sure that the peace talks resume and that they can actually address the root conflict in the Philippines of, you know, imperialism, feudalism, and what we call bureaucrat capitalism or the massive corruption in the government, the use of the government as basically a way to make money for the elected officials. And so I think what we need to be looking at here in the U.S. is to really pressure, put our pressure as a mass movement here in the U.S. to continue these peace talks, to promote the agenda for peace, to say, to inform people that, you know, these peace talks are not just an issue between the revolutionary government in the Philippines and the current government of the Philippines, but that it is an issue that affects all Filipinos living there, because the substance of those peace talks is about economic reform, about social reform, about land, about jobs, about eliminating poverty in the country. And so this is really an issue that affects us all, even for us here as migrants or children of migrants in the States, that our families were forced to move here because of the lack of opportunity in the Philippines. So it's really for us here in the United States to keep an eye on it, to keep informing people about it. And then also another task of us here in the United States is to make sure that we don't allow the United States to kind of interfere with the peace talks. We saw that the United States government again reiterated that the NPA was considered a terrorist organization, which might be an attempt to derail the peace talks. When John Kerry visited the Philippines, it was also around the same time where Duterte had this kind of volatile outlook on the peace talks with the ceasefire and such. And so we really want to make sure that the U.S. is not able to kind of intervene in the same way it did in countless other countries, Venezuela, Honduras. We've seen the effect that has in destabilizing governments and destabilizing the journey to peace. And so for us, we definitely want to keep a lookout for these developments and make sure that while at the same time we're fighting to resume the peace talks, mobilizing and organizing Filipinos, to also do that organizing work amongst people here in the United States to speak up and to speak up if the U.S. tries to do anything to derail those negotiations.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Adrian Bonifacio, chairperson of Anak Bayan USA, and Nat Pampana, the vice chairperson of the same organization. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.